Okay, this is the hour. We'll take your phone calls with Frank Lisciandro as we talk about the life of Jim Morrison, Frank's book, Jim Morrison, Friends Gathered Together. And we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Frank Lisciandro with us. Frank, tell us a little bit about the book, Jim Morrison, Friends Gathered Together, and where can people get it?
Well, essentially, people can get it on Amazon, and they can get it as an ebook through all the major platforms that have ebooks, their Kindle, the Nook, through iTunes. They can pick it up at one record store in LA and one bookstore in the Pacific Northwest. And that's about it, because I don't have a distributor. I'm a single book author and publisher, and you can't get a distributor if you just have one book. If there's a distributor out there that would like to handle this book, I'd be happy to talk to them. So mostly it's being sold through Amazon, and it's easy to order it on Amazon, and it comes right away. It's the full book, over 390 pages.
Well, good for you. Hey, I tell you what, when the interview is over, let's make sure that Tom gets me your email address. I'll send you the name of my New York literary agent, who's been very successful for me. And I'd like you to converse with them and send them a copy of your book, and let's see if they can help you with that.
Very kind of you, George. I'd appreciate that.
I'd love to see that. This is an amazing story. And, you know, in your opinion, Frank, what is the Jim Morrison story that you will never forget, the story that you would tell friends and family for the rest of your life?
Oh, boy. That's really difficult. There were so many incredible things that happened to us when, you know, we were with Jim. It seemed to me that things would just happen just because he was there. One day, I think we were in New Orleans, or it could have been Atlanta. We had gone to the film festival in Atlanta to present Feast of Friends, the film that just came out. This was in 69, if I remember correctly. And there was Rudolf Nureyev on an escalator going in the opposite direction that we were. And Jim said, "That's that Russian dancer guy." And
I said, "Yeah, the Russian Nureyev, dancer.
Yeah, that's who he is." Jim had to go talk to him. And so they talked for a while, and the comment that I remember Nureyev making was, said, "You would never have made a very good dancer with a big beard like that," because Jim had his
love
beard
it.
At the
he
time.
Had his beard then, yeah. Did he know who Morrison was?
He pretended to, but I don't think he did.
Well, of course, and Jim called him the Russian dancer guy, so...
He just, I'm sure he knew his name, but maybe he was trying to clue me in on before he said his name. I knew who he was, of course. We both knew who he was.
Was Jim approachable? You know, if a bunch of kids wanted his autograph, would he willingly do that? Or was he one of those that say, "Hey, stay away. No, we don't want anything to do with you"?
On several occasions, I was about to say many occasions, but I'll just say several occasions, we'd be walking to some place, because the area that we inhabited in Los Angeles, everything was close by. The Elektra studios were close by. The Doors office was close by. The Tropicana Motel, where all the musicians who came to town stayed. Everything was within walking distance. And people would see him on the street. We'd be walking along, maybe going to a meeting or who knows what we were doing. And they would say, "Oh, there's Jim." And they'd come across the street and they want him to sign autographs. You couldn't get him away from them. I mean, he was more
That's
interested
cool.
in talking to them than they were in seeing him on the street and having their autograph signed. So he was very approachable, and people loved that about him.
Of course, you know, he was right there during the Vietnam War. What did he think about politics, Frank? Did he ever express that to you?
There's one song, "The Unknown Soldier," that has a political bent to it. You know, I edited two books of Jim's poetry after he died. There's really no political poetry in any of the poetry, and there's only one song that refers to anything. His father was an admiral in the Navy during the war, and was actually in the Gulf of Tonkin when the war started.
How about that? Okay, let's take some calls for you for the rest of the hour. Let's go to Rob in Claremont, California. First-time caller. Rob, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you tonight?
Good.
Good. I was wanting to give some commentary on an article that came out this past summer, in August, in fact, about Marianne Faithfull in Mojo Magazine, who claims that her boyfriend at the time was a drug supplier of heroin, famously for the Rolling Stones, and in fact, he had given Jim the hot dose that killed him, and that's surrounding the mysterious death. They gave him a dose in a nearby nightclub. He died right there in the bathroom, and they took him home, dropped him in the bathtub, which is why he was backwards, you know, against the faucet. And the mystery is surrounding it. I mean, did you read that at all? I don't want to be up.
I did, Rob. I read that, of course. And, you know, here's the contradiction right away. She says the boyfriend came to the apartment where he left the drugs. Then somehow there's the rock and roll circus, the nightclub involved. Was Jim in the apartment or was he at the rock and roll circus? Did this drug dealer deliver the drugs to Jim where? I mean, the Marianne Faithfull story is a bit confused. And frankly, I don't believe it because, in fact, she was a heroin user at the time. And there's something about people who do something that want to include everybody else in it. You know, if you're doing heroin, you like to think the whole world's doing heroin.
Yeah.
I've noticed that myself by, unfortunately, having known some people who were addicted to heroin early on in my life. I don't believe any of the story. I don't know why she came out with it this late in her career.
That's suspect too, Frank. You know, when they come out really late after an episode occurred, you got to question that too.
I'm very much curious to know the facts and curious to really get the hard facts. Of course, except for Marianne Faithfull, everyone who involved in the story is dead. The drug dealer, he's dead. He was he apparently was responsible for the death of Janis Joplin because he delivered a hot shot to Janis Joplin and that killed her. The same guy. He liked to be the drug supplier to the rock and roll world. We've read about him in many places, and we know that he was a real person. But I just don't see Jim using drugs, that kind of drug. I mean, he abhored needles. He wouldn't go near to get a blood test from him was difficult. So
was he more of an alcoholic than a drug dealer, Frank?
A drug user?
Drug user, yeah. User, not dealer.
No, he was definitely an alcoholic, and he was a casual recreational drug user. You know, he'd try a little pot, he didn't like it, it made him too paranoid. He tried some cocaine, but, you know, it just speeded him up too much. He loved his alcohol, and it put him in a calm sort of place. I think, you know, he had an overactive mind, perhaps, or something. People said he was inhabited by demons. I don't quite believe that, but you know, alcohol is a way of sedating, and I think that's what he liked.
What was his drink of choice?
Jameson.
Ah.
Irish whiskey.
Wow. I bet he put a few of those down, huh?
Yeah, he drank to excess. I mean, you know, the guy could finish a bottle of whiskey virtually in a night by himself.
Ah.
So, you know, it was progressive alcoholism. We saw it progressing over time. And we were too young, too stupid, too uninformed to do an intervention, to get him to a clinic, to force him to stop. We thought, young, healthy guy, he's not going to die, you know. I mean, we all did a little drinking, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a popular thing to do in the 60s. Still popular today, I suspect. He was killing himself with alcohol.
Yeah, he was. I suspect his cirrhosis of the liver would have been huge had he continued on the path he was and not died of whatever he died of in that Paris hotel room.
He would have died eventually of disease connected with alcoholism.
Yeah,
he was just drinking
no question.
Too much. But, you know, several weeks before he left for Paris, a couple of weeks before he left for Paris, a bunch of us got together and played a game of touch football out on a field and somewhere in Manhattan Beach here in California. And, you know, Jim played for the full 2 hours with the rest of us. And there were some college young guys who were playing in the game with us. He played the entire time. You can read about it in the book. Rich Linnell, who organized the game, is one of the people I had a conversation with. He was a concert promoter at the time. Jim didn't show any signs of weakness, any signs of getting out of breath. I mean, he played as hard and as any one of us did during that touch football game. This was just a couple of weeks before he left for Paris.
Let's go next to Ann in Seattle. Welcome to the program, Ann. Go ahead.
Hi there. How you doing, George?
Good, Ann. Thank you.
I just love Jim Morrison so much because I grew up in Seattle, you know, in the 60s, late 60s. And my older sister introduced me to him like that. And I was like, you know, in my teens, and she was a little older. It's like, oh, Jim Morrison is just like the, you know, the lion. His voice was so deep. It's like if there was the Beatles and then there was Jim Morrison. It's like if you didn't know this in your life, you're really missing out. I just loved him so much. His music was prophetic.
Do you recall when he died in 1971? Where were you? Do you remember that?
Oh, I remember, but yeah, I just thought I was sad and everything, but I thought his music was bigger than his death. It's like he's never gonna die. If just the whole world should just know how his he came from like Dean Martin era or something, the Deep or Elvis he had or something he left us with, and
yeah, he was in your corner.
So deep.
How unique do you think he was, Frank, in her, his performance on stage?
I think there was only one Jim Morrison. I mean, later on, Iggy Pop and a bunch of other people imitated him. Maybe not imitated, just use him as an example. But when he was performing during the late 60s, he was the only person doing what he was doing. He was actually holding a seance, turning the rock stage into a theatrical stage, doing theater pieces for people, reciting poetry. It was wonderful. It was way different.
Was there ever a concert you were at and you knew, you said to yourself, he's drunk. He's drunk.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And you know what? Sometimes he went past that and was able to perform even if he was drunk. And sometimes it just collapsed. The whole performance collapsed. And you could see the other three guys in the band shaking their heads and knowing that it was going to be a disaster. But, you know, between the three of them, they managed to get the music out. And Jim managed to stand at the microphone and belt out the lyrics. And it only a few times did it turn into a real disaster.
I saw a clip of Elvis before he died at one of his concerts, and clearly he was on something. I don't know what it was, whether it was alcohol or prescription pills or who knows what. But, I mean, he was stumbling and mumbling along, and it was embarrassingly sad, Frank, to see that. Was Jim sometimes like that, where you just wanted to pull him off the stage?
You know, I was never at one of those concerts. I did attend a lot of concerts, both as a cameraman and as a photographer and as a friend and just hanging out with the band. And I don't think I saw that kind of performance out of him. I think he came close on some occasions, but I've heard that there were the last two performances that he did, one, I think, in Texas and one in New Orleans, that were really just the end of the road for the band performing.
Did the audience boo or did they cheer?
Well, for the performances I went to, they were usually left in dead silence at the end because they had never seen anything like it. I mean, they were reduced to just open mouth, open eyes, and nothing to say. Of course, many times they call for an encore, and he'd come out and do an encore. But the concerts I saw, the ones I attended, he was was really manipulating and using the audience and having fun with them, and they were getting off on it.
Yeah, and he would sometimes verbally attack them, and they would come back at him, and they all seemed to like that.
Absolutely. He loved that because, you know, otherwise he saw them just sitting there. They could have been sitting in front of their TVs, for goodness sake. He wanted them to participate,
yeah,
become part of the event, like Greek theater, in which the audience would become part of the event. There would be a chorus singing, the people in the audience might be singing with the chorus. There was some sort of participation. He hated to see just deadheads sitting there without making any noise, without clapping, without getting up and dancing. He encouraged him to come to the stage and dance.
Okay, next up, let's go to Jather in St. Louis. Hey, Jather, go ahead, sir.
Yes, hey, Frank, it's great to be talking to you tonight. I've just got a couple of opinions and one small question, okay? Admiral Nelson's son was an extreme genius, I think, and his poetry will live on for even 100 or 200 years from now, probably. So I'm real fired in and say, oh, my goodness, wow, you know. But my question is, with his ability of writing lyrical song and poetry and his ability in film, and do you think he could have possibly in the future have been the potential of becoming the first person to win or even be nominated for an Oscar for director, producer, and film score? What do you think about that?
That's an interesting question, and I've really not thought about that, but he was definitely headed towards film. When he went to Paris, he took with him the two films, actually he had sent to him the two films that he had participated in making in the United States, Feast of Friends and Highway. And he showed them to French filmmakers he knew, Jacques Demy, Agnès Varda, people like that who were luminaries in the French film industry at the time. And, you know, he wanted to crack through that barrier, become a film director, a filmmaker with a budget so that the money didn't have to come out of his pocket. And he wanted to make films. I mean, he went to film school because he wanted to be a filmmaker. There was a detour. He became a rock star instead. But he really wanted to do films.
What or who was his favorite group?
The Beach Boys.
Yeah, classics.
And Elvis. He adored Elvis, and he loved the Beach Boys.
Did he meet them?
We went to see Elvis one time during Jim's Tribe in Miami. Elvis was appearing in Miami somewhere, and Babe Hill and I and Jim went there. And, of course, we didn't go backstage or do any of that stuff, but we sat in the audience with all the other fans, just happy as could be, watching Elvis. This was the time when Elvis was still very, very powerful.
Oh, he sure was.
The big capes with the collars and stuff, and it was fantastic. And I don't know if Jim ever met any of the Beach Boys or not. I don't know that.
He was enlightening. Did he have, like the movie, did he have an altercation with a police officer on stage?
Yes, he did in New Haven. They came on stage and they busted him. And because he was telling the audience about what went on prior to that backstage, when a cop came backstage and thought he was, you know, Jim just dressed sort of normally or raggedly, let's call it. And some cop said, "Jay, you're not supposed to be back here." And Jim tried to tell him, "Look, I'm with the band." And the guy said, "No, you're not. You're He maced him. The cop maced him. And finally it was cleared up, and everybody apologized. But Jim got out on stage and used the occasion to talk about police brutality, and he was a victim of it. And the police didn't like it, and they came on stage, and they arrested him. The story is told beautifully in the book by Vince Traynor, who is, again, I mentioned it before, he was the road manager for the band. And he was there watching the whole thing, and the police were then again brutal before they took him away. I think he was one of the only performers, other than Lenny Bruce, ever to be arrested on stage during a performance
during his show
in the United States.
Stay with us, Frank. We're going to come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take final phone calls here as we talk about Jim Morrison, Friends Gathered Together. Have you had a chance yet to watch Beyond Belief, our television program? Well, you can this week running, of course. It's on survival and all kinds of techniques to help you and your family with Chris Geo. All you have to do is go to this website, watch it for free for 10 days. Not only that program, but everything else that you have the time to watch. Just go to beyondbelief.com. You can sign up right now to do that. www.beyondbelief.com. And welcome back to Coast with Frank Lisiandro, and we're going to be taking your final calls as well. Sounds Italian, Frank.
Yes, it is Italian.
Perfect, perfect, perfect. Where were you born? You mentioned Michigan State. My sisters went there.
Oh, no kidding. No, I was born in Brooklyn, New York, from an Italian-American family, and went to high school there. And then I wanted to be a photojournalist, and so I went to Michigan State because they had an excellent department for photojournalism at the time.
Yeah.
It was 1960. Later on, I decided, well, I'd like to be a writer and a a photographer, and maybe I'll just become a filmmaker because I could combine the two. So that's how I ended up at UCLA.
Are you still a Spartans fan whenever you watch them play?
When I watch them play and they're not playing against the Oregon Ducks, yes.
Oh, that's great. So in your career, how would you rate the friendship and the knowing of Jim Morrison? Where does that fit on your scale of life?
You know, it's very high because I've penned a couple of books about Jim. I took a lot of photographs of the band during the time. I was a photojournalist. I mean, that's what I did. I took, you know, documentary photographs of things and took a lot of photographs of the band and published them in a couple of books. And, of course, I've got Jim Morrison, Friends Gathered Together Now. I worked on Jim's films. I helped put together two books of his poetry after he died. I worked on the American Prayer album, which won a Grammy nomination in this country and the Edison Award in Holland for the best spoken word album. So I've been involved in and out during all the other things I do as a filmmaker and as a photographer. A lot of my time has been spent with Jim's legacy, presenting and showing people what a tremendously creative artist he was.
Frank, was he, in your opinion, did he have any suicidal tendencies? Did you see any of that?
You know, George, he took chances at times, but they weren't suicidal chances. They were just someone betting against a risk.
Was he reckless?
Yes, a little bit so. And we always took the car keys away from him. We never let him drive, or tried never to let him drive when he was drunk, of course, because we were in the car with him. We didn't want to die. But he was reckless, and, you know, he would do kind of crazy things. But he had an athlete's body. He could walk on the ledge of a building 20 stories above Sunset Boulevard and get away with it. He was just sure of himself about those things. I saw him do some amazing, sort of crazy things. And maybe he was a young guy and he was just testing himself, but a little too reckless at times.
Ah, all right. Let's go to Roman in Melbourne, Florida now, east of the Rockies. Melbourne, thank you, Roman, for calling. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good evening. Frank, Jim Morrison said that he described his body of work, his art, if you will, as an invitation into a private form of thought, and that to understand him and his life, one not need look simply at his lyrics and his verse, his poetry. I'd like to make an observation and then a question for you. I'd submit that the greatest influence in Jim's life, if you will, the Rosetta Stone to understanding who he was, mystery behind his lyrics, is in the guise of an individual who's still very much alive, and that is Mary Frances Werbelow, his first love, his first girlfriend, an individual that's not really talked about much, but very much at the centerpiece of Jim's life, played a very pivotal role. Just curious if Jim ever mentioned her to you, and what you think of that assessment, the role that Mary Frances Werbelow played in the fact that he was never able to reconcile with her, which may have actually pushed him over the edge.
Roman, you live in the town that Jim Morrison was born in, Melbourne, Florida.
Yeah, he does.
And, you know, I never met Mary. I've heard other people talk about her. Jim really didn't talk about the woman in his life. He was so discreet, such a Southern gentleman. He never said a word about any of the women in his life. And so I never had those conversations. But I've come to know about her through other people. And an interview, I think, I read that was carried in a Florida newspaper maybe a dozen years ago. I would love to meet her someday. I'd love to get her stories about Jim, the young Jim. I don't know, or I can't help you with an answer to that question.
Okay, next we go to Springfield, Massachusetts. It's Ray's turn on Coast to Coast. Ray, you're on with us. Go ahead.
Yes, George, wonderful show. I'm really enjoying this.
Thank you.
Frank, I've been a big fan of your photography and your writing for years. I mean, I was 12 years old when I bought An Hour for Magic. But I've always had this one question. When you guys did A Feast of Friends, was there extra film that was either lost over the years or, you know, the stuff that was edited out Is any of that stuff, is it just gone forever now, or was it saved, or have, do you have any idea? I know it's a tough question maybe, but...
No, it's not really a tough question. You know, the recent release of Feast of Friends on DVD and Blu-ray, that has an extra sort of added element, a 30-minute piece that was made from the outtakes, and so you'll see stuff that didn't make it into the original film. And Ray used a bunch of footage from Feast, some of the outtakes, some of the stuff we didn't use in some of his music videos that he was making in the 80s. You know, a lot of the concert footage was not used because either it was too dark in the hall or, you know, the sound wasn't good. I think we presented the best of what was shot. And, of course, we did shoot for Feast of Friends, the entire Hollywood Bowl concert, which was then recently just put out as a DVD called The Doors at the Hollywood Bowl, I believe. A wonderful film because it includes all of the footage that Paul and I and a couple of other cameramen shot during that wonderful concert, one of the best Doors concerts ever, I think. So between the Doors at the Hollywood Bowl and this new release of Feast of Friends with extra added footage, I think you get most of the footage we shot.
I would guess when Jim Morrison was on, he was very good at what he did.
He was really good. And I think if you look at that performance at the Hollywood Bowl, some people said he was on LSD at the time, and that's another urban rumor, but I don't know how anybody could have that kind of control and be on LSD at the same time, but it's a wonderful performance. And there were a couple of other good performances, too, that have been captured on film. One of them is included in this package. It's called The Doors Are Open, when the Doors appeared in London at the Roundhouse. Another stunning performance by the Doors.
I know talking to Krieger and Manzarek a few years ago, they were very frustrated sometimes with Morrison. I think they probably felt that they were helpless, don't you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. There was, you know, Jim's credo was, freedom first, my freedom first. I mean, he didn't want to be told what to do. He didn't want to be told how to do it. I mean, he would be cooperative. He could be a group player. There's no doubt about it. But if you told Jim Morrison to do this, he would do the opposite. So and he wasn't interested in going to meetings about business affairs. He, you know, hardly attended them or attended them without paying attention to them. So it was difficult with him. And, you know, because he was an alcoholic, and many times he would have appear on the scene drunk, and which made it hard for the other band members, you know, to, you know, what are you going to do with a guy like that?
I mean, did he, like, drink 24/7, Frank?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I mean, he had to have clear moments because he wrote, look, George, you know, people think that he was good for nothing. Here's a guy by the age of 27, had appeared in hundreds of concert dates across the country, completed 6 studio albums, 3 self-published books of poetry. He made 2 films. All this before the age of 27. I mean, most of us don't get accomplished all of that by the time we reach 71.
No, that's true. He lived his life. There's no doubt about that. Let's go to Keith in Rochester, New York now. Hi, Keith. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, I have a fast point about Jim and Brian Jones, but first, Brian passed at age 26, not the famous 27. He was born at the end of February 1943, and when George Harrison heard the date, he said, "Hey, you and I were born 2 days apart." 1943 was the big year that many of these rockers were born, including Mick Jagger. And my question is, did you know that Jim and Brian both passed, they both died actually on July 3rd, 2 years apart, Brian in 1969, and water, of course, factored into both their deaths, Brian drowning in his pool and Jim in 71 in the bathtub. But people love dates concerning rock and roll, but I've never heard politely that Jim and Brian both passed on that famous July 3rd. And it was 2 years apart, and I've never heard that mentioned before.
But thanks for bringing that up. I think that's really a interesting point. I was always under the impression, and a lot of people are, that Brian died at 27, so we'll have to check our facts again. Thanks for correcting us there. And you know that Jim wrote a poem several days after Brian Jones died called Ode to L.A. While Thinking of Brian Jones Deceased, which he had printed and then given out at a concert at the Aquarius Theater in Los Angeles, a tribute, as in a kind of a tribute, a reflection on what it means to be a rock star, and a tribute to Brian Jones.
You know, and I've got to ask you, too, when they were on the Ed Sullivan Show, didn't Sullivan want them to change the lyrics to Light My Fire?
He didn't want the word higher used. He thought it was a drug reference. And he said, substitute some other word. So, just as I said a few minutes ago, you tell Jim to do something. And if he's not on board with you, he's just going to do the opposite. So, of course, the song came out on the Ed Sullivan Show with them singing higher. The word higher was in the song, as it should be. Apparently, Ed Sullivan said they'd never come back on the show.
By the way, Brian Jones was 27 when he died. He was born February 28th, 1942. And he died on July 3rd, 1969.
That's 27.
So, he was 27 plus, so he's in the club.
Absolutely.
He's in the club. Okay, good. Yeah, you were off a little bit on that, Keith, but so be it. Let's go next to Carlos in Carson City. Carlos, go ahead.
Yes, good evening. A couple of quick questions. What does the name Doors stand for? Is it the doors to heaven, to hell, to spirituality? Huh.
Well, it comes from the book The Doors of Perception by Aldous Huxley, which was a book about psychedelic experience. They took their name from that book title, and I think originally they thought of calling themselves The Doors of Perception and then later just shortened it to The Doors.
Favorite Doors song, Frank, what is it?
Oh, I've got so many. Soul Kitchen, I love that one. L.A. Woman is fabulous. What about Universal Mind? A song that's not played often, but just a great song. All of them written by Morrison.
I'd pick Light My Fire, but you're right. They had a lot of great ones.
Absolutely.
Let's go next to Louie in Central Coast, California. Louie, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Okay, I am a first-time caller and longtime listener, and George Frank, I'm... And thank you for a real wonderful show, but I've got a really neat Doors story. I was stationed in Central California at Merced Air Base, and I heard that the group Love was playing at the roller skating rink in the city north of where I was stationed, and I decided to go see Love, and Love had cut their first album. And I was excited to go see them. And this three-piece group opened up for Love. There was the singer, the guitarist, and the keyboardist. And they sang some really, really neat songs. And they turned out to be the Doors. 30 days later.
That was a very fortunate decision you made to go hear Love and see the Doors at the same time. I never heard about that concert. It sounds fabulous to me.
You know, what were they charging for concerts back in the 70s and the 60s? Jeez, a fraction, I bet, of what they charge now.
I remember $3 you could get you into the Avalon and the Fillmore, $3 to $5 and get you three acts in one night.
That's something. Let's go to Mark in Los Angeles as well. Mark, take it away. Go ahead.
Hey there. How about When the Music's Over? Favorite song.
Great song.
Absolutely great song. Great song.
You know, I wish some of the young musicians today could hear some of the records that Jim and the band made, like Soft Parade, Waiting for the Sun, Strange Days. You know, those the lyrics were just incredible. And, you know, that's something that a lot of these kids don't get to hear now. But, you know, I have a question for you about transcendental meditation, and that is, I know several of the guys in the band were into it when they were popular, but did Jim ever learn how to meditate? Was he in it or against it, or what was the deal?
You know, I don't think Jim ever did transcendental meditation. Robbie and John were deep meditators, I guess I can say that.
They were into that, yeah.
Ray did meditation on and off for some time. Jim didn't have seem to have an interest in it, or if he did, it was an intellectual curiosity. As far as I know, he didn't practice it.
Let's go to Joe, Bronx, New York. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Good, Joe.
Great show tonight. Frank, I'd like to ask you now, I did get the opportunity to meet John Densmore. What influence or what was the relationship, and was it close, between Densmore and Morrison? And also, did Jim Morrison play any musical instruments? And I have another question. Does he have any offspring? Does Morrison have any offspring?
Well, let's take the offspring question first. Not that I know of, although there were claims of paternity while he was alive. I don't know how those worked out, but there are at least one that I know that claims he's a son of Jim Morrison. The relationship between John and Jim was strained at times, and you could read about it in John's book, his first book. I think he talks about it. But, you know, there was a bit of a strain between the band and Jim after the band decided that they would let Light My Fire go as an advertisement for a car company. And Jim was entirely against it, and so there was a strain there between the members of the band. Jim wasn't interested in money. He didn't seem to have that commercial concept about what he was doing. He really would have preferred to do a lot of free concerts, and he tried to get the band to do free concerts. I don't think they ever did one.
Let's take one more call if we have some time here. Robert's in Cleveland. Robert, go ahead.
I've been working on what Jim was singing about, his lyrics and their meaning, for years. You know, he was really singing about enlightenment. Take the crystal ship. You played that at the beginning of the show.
Yeah.
Scientists today have figured out that the universe is like a hologram. That's the crystal ship. The crystal ship is being filled. Being is the essence of what we truly are. The crystal ship is the universe, or the images before us.
Good point.
I really loved it. I thought that was great, and I'd like to read more of your thoughts about Jim's lyrics, because I think enlightenment and freedom were central to what he was singing about.
Frank, I will follow through on a little pledge here for you. I'll get you the literary agent in New York, and get your book to them and see if they can help you get it distributed, okay?
Thank you, George. I really do thank you for that, and I would like to encourage people to pick up the book as a Christmas gift for anybody who loves The Doors or Jim Morrison or anybody who loves rock music or is interested in the culture and music of the 60s, because that's what the book's about.
Frank, thank you for such a fascinating interview. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, George. It was great being on.
Have yourself a great Christmas, too, you and your family, all right?
You too, and a great New Year.
The Doors. Doesn't get much better than that, does it? In a moment, of course, we're going live to the United Kingdom. There's more on Coast to Coast as we talk about souls and the spirit.